Cassie and I moved here 6 months ago this weekend. Today. Mm-hmm. This hour. We were filled here 6 months ago with boxes. It? Yeah, 6 months. Yeah, yeah. It comes to seem that way. The shadow casts longer mm-hmm. and longer. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, so this is, like, we've had Victor over a couple times, but this is the first time we had a real gathering.
This is the first time I've been off a leash, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's back there, behind there. It's okay. soaking in the leather oil, so it'll be nice and...
I'm hearing what you're saying.
Yeah. It's okay. So the other thing is that the other coincidental date is that it was 6 years and 3 months ago that I last had a gathering of this type with friends, artists, whatever. and it was on the other side of the continent. Because the last time I was in a group, it was like people from Connecticut, Boston, and New York, mostly, that met various places when I was in college and at jobs I had. And so these meetings that this is a kind of sequel to, they took place in Connecticut in a restaurant, in the back room of an old restaurant, an old Italian place. And we had them for 13 years. And then they ended because I knew I was moving out west and my head was not invested in the East Coast anymore. I thought, well, I'm just going to keep this idea with me. And someday it'll come to pass that I'll know enough people who I think brought together for such an event would have a good time and would generate some sparks. So it's been 6 years and 3 months in the searching for tonight. Lastly, I wrote, Victor asked me, what is going to be happening? Why am I coming to your house with all these other people? You asked me that.
It's true, because, you know, I was thinking, do I need to be heavily medicated?
Yeah. Or do I need to bring lots of quarters and small bills?
Yeah, yeah. I got some dollar bills I've been saving for, you know, a trip over to Southeast Portland. But
plenty of places to spend.
So Victor was asking me, well, what is it that, what is this idea you have? Please let me in on it. And he asked me by email about a week ago, and...
Son of a bitch sent me a letter.
Yeah, I wrote him a letter.
All right.
Because I was sitting at there's this cool 24-hour coffee house in Beaverton called Ava Rosteria.
24-hour cool coffee shop?
In Beaverton, yeah.
Where?
Like right in the old town downtown part of Beaverton.
They turned out into a cool 20... Yeah. Place shaped like that, kind of a pie-shaped place, or is it another place? No, it sounds like a different place, but it's not pie-shaped. Downtown Beaverton?
Yeah, yeah. They have live music.
Great live music. Comes out from Beaverton.
Yeah. But anyway, I was sitting there, and I was thinking about Victor's question, and I thought, oh, well, I can't answer this question about this thing I want to tell them about in an email. I just don't like email, I've decided. And my email program has recently decided it doesn't like me. So we've been having more problems. But I wanted to give him an answer. And I wanted to write a letter, because I like writing letters. They've become more and more something they didn't used to be. People don't... Like, emails now is like the way letters used to be. It's sort of commonplace, and letters have become this other thing. So anyway, I wrote a letter to Victor, which he said he'd read tonight.
Oh, my God.
As a way of explaining, firstly and finally.
Okay, it's all it takes a minute to find my voice here.
Just do your best.
March 21st, 2008, 11:11 p.m., Ara Rosteria, Beaverton, Oregon. And ironically, somehow it starts on page 2. Right? Dear Victor, you asked me what the Jellicoe Literary Guild is. What next week's meetings will be like, what I foresee, to answer you rightly, I have to do two things. Use a pen and paper, envelope, and a stamp. I reach years back in my history. When I met you in Portland in 2002, I was riding the end of a high wave until it crashed. Just months before, I'd been living in Boston, been years living there. but had left in pursuit of a dream, to do with a girl, to do with living out west, to do with pursuing my art in new spaces, see how far I could take it, and what I could, what I would give up for it. The Jellicle Guild had been a part of this left-behind life, and I did not expect it to occur again. When I began it in 1988, I was in graduate school in Connecticut, not even yet left my home state for Boston. I knew many friends from college who wrote, played music, read strange books, drank much booze, puffed ganja, and liked to push hard into the night. Nights and days. Nights and days being lived in the nowhere that is central Connecticut. And its endless cluster of same-looking towns and cities where the high-riding concerns were and are still taxes, cable TV, and the lottery numbers. But we had something among us, this loose crew with students and teachers and freaks living in the last exhaust of... Reagan's. I knew this. I struggled with this before. In the last exhaust of Reagan's America, and I wanted to push it. Then I read a book by Humphrey Carpenter called The Inklings. The Inklings. See, I mean...
Really?
Wait. Wet my whistle here. And it hit. This book detailed the World War II and post-war literary cliques at Oxford and Cambridge universities in England. In particular, The Inklings, a small band of writers included J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis. That was it. I'd gather my people up monthly, like the Inklings in their regular meetings, and we'd read and sip and grok each other.
Sing.
Okay. And we would read and sing and grok each other.
Wonderful.
Began in December 1988. I took a while to cohere everything, but eventually the shape developed it as thus. Four times in the spring, early summer, and four times in the autumn, early winter, we'd gather in the back room of Roma's restaurant in New Britain, Connecticut, an Italian-Polish spirit working man's bar, good food and beer, and our bunch took over that brown-paneled room with notebooks and guitars, pitchers of beer, moments subtle and others ridiculous, and we'd wend our unscripted way from about 8 in the evening until the joint closed at 2. People came and went out in the years. I guess over 100 people total, but I could see I could be wrong. I kept a few scribbled notes and tape-recorded many meetings. I captured of it all what I could for what I knew it was, for what I knew it was special. Knew, Victor, that those gatherings in those obscure places, before the internet allowed people to breach each other's surroundings and whatever kind of limitations it held for them. Remembering Jim Burke, the laughing mystic guitar player, lover of strong gins and tonic, a fine female ass, Mark Chorette, who wrote delicate, powerful poetry, a pacifist, save when he screamed for blood while watching hockey games. Jerry Dillon, curly-haired and writer of science fiction epics and lover of beauty and mayhem alike. Mark Burgeon, a 20th-century hippie poet, minstrel, with the philosophical heart of a 17th-century scholar. Ralph Emerson, the same? You did run with some eyebrow glue, didn't you?
He was old, too.
Ralph Emerson, a tall, thoughtful man of far learnings and possessing of an endless, charming smile and laugh. I could list on for pages, but suffice to say, I was one with the brothers and artists, and when I moved to Boston, I met new brothers, and brought them down too, save for the occasional meetups up there at the lovely old Jacob Smirth's restaurant. Did you follow that? Did you get that?
In Boston.
Rick Amante, savagely good poet, lover of wine and song, dancer, seer, Joe Ciccone, built like a pro fullback player with a heart tender for a good melody. Let me try that one more time. Joe Ciccone, built like a pro football player, fullback football player. I never thought this would work. with a heart tender for the good melody. And accompanying Hobbitale, Michael...
Hobotale.
Hobotale. What the hell's a hobotale?
A tale of hobos.
Oh. And accompanying Hobotales. For the good melody and accompanying Hobotales.
A heart tender for the good melody.
He's tender for hobos.
He's tender for Hobotales.
Hobotales. Huh. Ooh, that's kind of...
Hobotale, yeah.
Yeah.
Is that the night job or the day job?
I think I would have left him out entirely.
Yeah, sorry.
Tender for hobo tails.
Tender for hobo tail.
But that's my phrase.
And you spelled tail wrong. You spelled T-A-L-E.
Yeah. It was encoded.
I'm so ruining your letter. Michael McLaughlin, deep lover of 19th century writers like Hawthorne, Melville, always one for the cigar, bourbon, and progressive metal bands when possible. There were sisters, too, though fewer. Barbara Brannan, extraordinary artist, and Virginia Bergeron, also a great artist. The night began with good food and drink, and then we would go around to
sharing.
Then we would go around sharing what we had written, though read, thought, and songs and raw stories, and around a few more times. I should try that one more time. Wait, here we go.
I feel like I'm torturing
you. All you guys are just... It feels like you're looking at me or something. You guys just pretend like to do what you're doing. You're doing excellent. The night began with good food and drink, and then we would go around sharing what we'd written, read, thought, and songs and rod stories, and around a few more times. There would be a break to hit the bar. There would be a break to hit the bar, the head, and the ganja pipe. There would be a crescendo of laughter, shouting, chains falling.
Chairs,
chains. I mean, bust out the zipper-faced leather hood, right? There would often be a crescendo of laughing, shouting, chairs falling. Beer pitchers everywhere, golden wild nights. Over 13 years, especially the last couple, the group disintegrated some. My own life in Boston was sinking into depression, unemployment, isolation, and I probably brought some of this down with me, even as I brought new issues of the Cynical and my notebooks. It ended because I was leaving the East, and it was time. So it's been over 6 years since the last meeting, and you wonder what to expect as of your first. I wonder too, Victor, save to know that my instinct has told me that it was time and the place to carry on. I begin again. We will begin, specifically, with some of my old ideas and memories, but where to go I cannot say. I hope and expect by night's end, however, to have honored what was those long years ago, and to have both raised their specter a little higher, and laid it a little more peaceably to rest. Cannot wait. 3/2/2008. Peace and love.
Maybe that's it.
Sorry about that. Not really.
So that was my explanation to Victor, and I thought first I'm going to mail to you, then you'll own it for a day. It'll be yours, and then it'll be like, okay, now read it to everybody.
And I did read it.
And you did. You did.
I did.
Yeah. As though you'd only were reading it for the first time.
No, that was the second time. It was the second time.
I believe you. Sorry. Yeah, I got a letter from you, Ray. Yeah. It's right here.
Yeah, as soon as I can decipher serial killer handwriting,
yeah.
I'm going to go ahead and try it. Give it a whirl.
You have to understand. I was a cop and they wrote the letters.
But then it's just interpretation, right? Mm-hmm. You
could be anything.
Yeah.
This man's threatening the president in this letter.
Just make sure you don't mail it from your local post office. Use gloves.
I'll get a bike messenger. Yeah. You know, I didn't match that, right?
So that's my explanation for this night, and if there were never another gathering that had anything to do with the idea that Victor just laid out, it wouldn't matter because I wanted to do it again, and if it happens again, that'd be fantastic. But I think that I wanted to test it out under other circumstances, other people. So I wanted, Michael, when you're, I'd like to ask you to, if you would, read stuff. Oh, Michael's a very good writer. And he's kind of hidden, but I know him well enough to, like, ask him to bring his notebooks and beg him to, read them.
Hidden?
No, you're kind of hidden. These guys aren't hurting. There's a lot of hiddenness in Portland. It's true of any city.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, somebody will have their, like, following their group, but then outside of, like, a relatively small number of people, they just won't even be known.
This isn't my stuff, but do you guys know who Joaquin Miller is?
No.
Joaquin Miller was a strange guy in the company. He was mid-19th century when he was born, I think, in, like, Cincinnati or something like that, somewhere in the West. But that's not, you know, we consider the West, but Ohio was the West back in the 1830s. And then he went west and went to John Day and was, like, the county judge for Grant County for several years. Became a writer and went through all sorts of strange things. He was in the Bay Area for a while. Continued to be a writer. He did other things like being a judge and politician. Anyways, never was any success in the U.S. whatsoever. Then he went to London and built a miner's shack in Hyde Park and became like this huge celebrity around Europe because he'd go around. He grew out a really long beard, like your stereotype, you know, mountain man. So he was like an American mountain man living in the middle of London, right? And then became very famous. But so, anyways, he went around Europe in that role for a good chunk of his life. And anyways, I've always been kind of fascinated by the guy. I want to learn more about, you know, just exactly who he was and how he got there.
Is he still alive?
Oh, no. He was 1830 to, like, 1910 or something like that.
Wow.
15, yeah.
He lived a long, obscure life.
Yes, long, obscure life. So, published a lot of stuff. So, anyways, I just picked this book up off the shelf at Powell's today, and then I just turned to a thing where I thought this was wonderful, where he was talking about having dinner with Dante Gabriel Rossetti, who was an Italian poet, guy who, I don't know if you know anything about Dante Gabriel Rossetti, he buried his poetry with his wife, only to have her exhumed 7 years later so he could get it back.
Take backs are a bitch.
Yeah. Is that literal? I thought you were like,
no.
Buried with poetry was why we thought he like gave up poetry when she died.
No, he
literally
buried it with her. It literally had like the
Christina
an undertaker. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
had an undertaker dig her up and dry the pages out, but it was all.
Oh, he had the undertaker. He
yeah, had
he regretted his
wanted his poetry back.
Wow.
7 years later. Anyways, Joaquin Miller was having dinner at Dante Gabriel Rossetti's house, and I believe
is this before or after she died?
I don't know. I like I said, I just grabbed this off the shelf.
And I can imagine, like, in that 7 years in between, he's, like, talking to friends. They're like, yeah, you know. What do you think about exhumation?
You think it's worth it?
Yeah. I wrote some good poetry back then.
I'm going to go to hell anyway because I'm a poet. Or in hell.
So this is something, this is just,
that is a really crazy story, Michael. Heard that
well,
story.
I thought this was cool. I thought this was interesting. This is Joaquin Miller having dinner with. Dante. The poets have interesting lives, and this is Joaquin Miller talking about having dinner with Dante Gabriel Rossetti. By and by, he quietly said that silence was the noblest attitude in all things, that the greatest poets refused to write, and that all great artists in all lines were above folly of expression. A voice from far down the table echoed the sentiment by saying, "Heard melodies are sweet, but unheard melodies are sweeter. Written poems are delicious, but unwritten poems are divine," cried the triumphant cynic. "What is poetry?" cries a neighbor. "All true, pure life is poetry," answers one. "But the inspiration of poetry, the art of poetry is in books, the inspiration of poetry in nature." To this all agreed. Then the master, bending close, said softly to me, "Poetry his soul set to music. I love that. I just pulled that off the shelf and opened the book to that. And I was like, oh, that's pretty good. Pretty awesome. The stars called on their muses to release the chains that bound the sunlight, to allow this new hope to run free in the playgrounds of the masses, to become part of the shared unconscious once again. Poetry, the music of the soul, and your ears gone out of tune from the tone-deaf cackling of the soul-killer corporations. Slow down now and breathe deep. The chains released. Take a long look around. Everything's changed in the new white light, and don't mistake the way your eyes ache from the blindness for another bout with the uncertain fear. Everyone gets scared standing at St. Peter's Gate, thinking we know our own judgments, but you never know for certain until you take the step through. You'll either walk amongst the clouds and sing with angels or scream eternal agony as your feet blister and peel from the flames of too many nights pursuing your own pleasures. You'll never know the verdict until you step through the gate and the door just opened wide.
Hey, that was nice.
Here's another one I wrote last week. Two cities split by a wide river, and I am the bridge over the ever-flowing waters. On the west side, an unknown tomorrow, the gambling fate of the future, shiny glass buildings and all-night neon. But until the reluctant settler crosses over my shoulders, he can never know with certainty what dreams or what unintended curses lurk in the steady artificial glow. Or who the denizens are of those steel monsters, heads in the fog on cold spring mornings. The engineers of promise, the bankers of death, or the white-collar masses just holding their breath until 5 o'clock, huddled tight on the narrow west bank. On the east side, a wide plain, a gentle valley, the comforting decay of homes built before anyone imagined the incessant noise of digital data and electronic hum that threatens to drown the last poetic cries like polar bears on the final ice floes as the North Pole boils around them. The east bank is old and worn, slow like the stopping of time in the Garden of Eden. Yet the poisoned apple dangles over an unassuming corner in the west, an ancient storefront at Third and Oak where a long-ago settler grabbed his future. And now I'm stepping up and considering the stakes. This long-ago settler gambled his future, and now I'm stepping up. Considering the stakes.
All right.
Hey, that's all right.
Thank you. Yeah. So. I'm not a sorceress, though I've studied how to corral the wind for you. I spent my days collecting the secret clues you left in empty beer glasses and marijuana smoke. And alone in the library at night, I drew pictures and sang nonsense lyrics, chanting the hours away for the half-second flash that might tell me what the last step is, what I need to do to harness the sun for you, to catch the air I breathe and give it to you, to clear my eyes of fear's fog and look at you. I don't have the serpent's powers you forever see in me. I haven't spoken to the deities you feel for me, and my name is not Diana or Andromeda or Helen. I'm nothing more, nothing less than a girl growing older. A girl who didn't find the truth at home, who came here to escape all the simple stares and loveless sensibility that trapped me in an eyeless universe. Now I'm here, and I want to make magic for you. I want to enchant this city with you. I want to laugh at the mad ones and sneer at the sane and dance all day and sing. And your eyes tell me you're ready. You're waiting for the resurrection. And all I am is a confused woman, bound in love and loathing, and I can't possibly become your messiah.
So. Wow.
So. I had a dream kind of like that one night, where I went down to the St. Vincent de Paul's right down from my house, and it's kind of like an old supermarket where you step on the little entry pad, and the door swings open like that. So it was still the St. Vinny's there, but so I walked down there, because I walked down there a lot, went into there, and that was where you got your muse on loan.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to write a little poem for this girl, and I was like, so I go down to the muse store, go in there, and there's like this cantankerous little old guy at a desk, and I'm like, I'd just like to get a little muse to be able to write a little love poem. It's kind of nonsensical kind of a thing. And he's all, sorry, we're all out, all we have is this one. And it was the epic one. You know, it was like a giant Frankenstein monster muse, and you go, I'll just suffer.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome.
at this point, I'm going to not even say that it's about art. Because what I really think is that what Michael's talking about in terms of channeling something is a beautiful way to kind of heal yourself and to let yourself become something larger than just your individual self, which we promote so strongly in society that causes kind of sickness, that we begin to not think of other problem-solving techniques. And so I think to put genius into works and then spread them out, to disseminate them, are a way to change society. Because I think that different kinds of artistic elements can have sort of a hieroglyphic component. And if you can, you know, insert a feeling in a certain way when it's in there, it might be able to be extracted, especially by people in, you know, alternative states of mind. And I think that you see evidence of that in different kinds of hieroglyphic arts, especially from
Jungian symbolism too.
Yeah, and you know, it's like it's meant to engage you, and not just for you to go, okay, this is just like, you know, these people lived in magical cultures. This is how they experienced life, and it wasn't that they were, you know, such dumb imbeciles and were such great, you know, people that their stuff had no credence. I think it gave them a lot of inspiration and power. And I think that we are very disempowered, and whatever we can do as people to empower ourselves now is important.
Well, good. What I hear what you're saying actually is the idea of mythology and how mythology has been lost,
and how we can create it for ourselves, for our own,
or at least piece one together that fits for you.
And that, man, if that works for you, that is golden. Because so many people are walking around without any kind of mythology at all, and I think that makes people pretty nihilistic. So
or the ones they were
something.
Handed.
What do you say?
Or the ones they were handed.
Yeah, which is
that they don't really.
People inevitably find out that there's hypocritical elements, but you know, when you create it yourself, you can have those.
Build in the hypocrisy.
We're all internally inconsistent in ourselves, and we don't have to idolize ourselves and have this kind of, you know, broken feeling. I come from Florida, and it's like the people that are the most Christian crusaders, you always find them, you know, somewhere at the strip club with, you know, the midgets on top of horses, and then someone, you know, takes a picture of them. I swear to God, there was a guy there who, at the court case, claimed it was his evil twin brother that did everything. And it's just like, you know, I thought you were weird being a Christian preacher and having that role in the government.
I'm going to read a poem. I wrote this... I finished it in December of 2004. I was writing it for several months, and it was the last poem in a group of poems that I'd been writing for about 4 years. And it was actually a long series of poems. It was 359 poems before this one.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a series. It's on my website, and it's very long, called 6x36 Nocturnes. And I was writing for 4 years, and it was a total of 360 poems. Yeah, good time. So this was the last one. And what I tried to do, and I don't... It's a poem that I tried to write to stand on its own, but it also is a poem that is a conclusion of a long series and a long time of writing it. So it has both... You've either come to this poem on its own, which you guys have, or you've come to this poem having read 200 pages of previous poems. And both paths are valid. But that's all I'm trying to say. So. It's called Cry for Cassandra. Cry out from this world's narcotic delusion, ceaseless flu of want. Once, twice, cry out. Now breathe, relax. Reckonals burst from flowers of flame, and what lasting? Nocturnes? White leaves on a tree made of music. Drums and dust, nothing. What abide? Love? Secret sugar raging creation's scattered heart. Something, and how intensely still. What begins, and a beat, and begins again? Everything. Call it hunger, the clawing rhythm within, maze of heart's ripe thirst and need's hard flail. Learn it, if you would anything of matter. What shaman in every pain and its sate? Secret joys, within's within, light and salve for a seeker's chase. Hark moments sweet, desire's lovely acceleration, and a beat and a crash. Now behold, ruins potent, fisted maze a skyless mountain tall. Cry out till the coil loosens life again through the bite and the burn. Once, twice, what lasting? Breathe, relax. Garden clues toward a bouquet of answers. Sing them new, strum them high, embrace them all, let them go, see what remain. Just blue flashes cross the mind's troubled stretch, till night flickers up, great flashing hours of root and roam. Dreams climb high with the moon, trace beauty's darkling arc into the loam, roughest making stuff, mercy near, world's crown and flute. A beat again, now come a dream of charred figure chanting golden song, his tune how love greens the gritless land, his urge to subtract everything from the world and reveal God, his haunt what conjured steps to build up again. Cry out with him, once, twice, caterwaul crack wide, creation's sliding hum, its tart melody and lawless currying of beats, unruly music struck from holy emptiness, loosed as worlds without end, feel it, the helpless want for wordless things, ever squirm in the eyes and blood. I know you know. Lean, withdraw, a beat, another. Let cry for your loss, not everything lost, but still cry for yours, sure they for you. Memory skids, blood's swelling tang, heart's wistful delusions, lights and hurry. Sad with a dream of vined unity, a flesh, a spirit, slave to nothing. Say again, all glory passeth. What lasting? Black ink on white char? What abide? Love's freakest draws new from nada. Smile, wake up. Desire triggers its own laws. Happiness. Though riven by stride, sink, roar, and fade, raised for feed by kings and preachers and trinket swingers, still dream a body ache ceaseless toward the flow. Something greater, music hints, forests and seas, first kiss, hundredth, cry out, truly, and heed what overrun senses, what your cry has ever blown through your hustling fingers, the hungry press of your laughter, what collects in your grief, chimes in your dreams, sprays you wide, exhales your want, long linger, greater music, greater silence, a frenzied high called art. What lasting? Black barks and white chips of moon? Sung spent years, their scald remain. What abide, love? Its anarchy spits wild in the heart, poison to the land's mass of moving men. What begins in a beat and begins again? The singing, the squalor, spirit's craze of sacred and muck, farthest hour's storm of drums and dust. Rootless siege in the question, how to live, how to live, how to live and why. Hope like a spell binds the heart to wishes and then come a sweet thing into this raw stretch. Thick flicking dirge, her gestures mesmer like a slow salmon dusk, her loving stroke true. We skein home together after years in another life. No more veils, cry out. What conjures awake this world's carnal dream music? How display freer solitude's blue fancies? Shake and deny, squeeze yesterday's loose, then believe, soul plus soul, sum to soul. World something drones in all melody, it hurts, I know you know, but little holds against the true stroke. Hum and mullet, how to build up again, wield new furies with a softer heart, raise new thrill songs from higher music within, crack harder bluffs, chase the green pulsing, seed wisdom's first verities, follow into the pink currents, once jittering play in the maya, jerk, groove, careen, nod everything lost, caterwaul, and a beat, reinvent, reinvent, and reinvent. Now breathe, relax, nothing ends but faith in old costumes. Keep along, many names for beloved, this one firmed your bones, that one riped your blood, others taught and took in a week's snap or a year's all. Where come the will to accept? Countless rank aches till your raggy soul knows to hark every new day's golden fineness. Come a sweet thing, thus love unto greater real. Stranger path, a build bare pilgrim among adoration's many musics. Once, twice, not enough. Clench, release, sing it new, strum it high, what lasting? Black drizzle down white skies? What abide, love? Call it first and last flower of the world. Clue, harass. Bed's better dreaming, night's open range lure. What begins and the beat and begins again? Where creation's savage engine? What its spark? What is? Whither next? Does this strange world sum to nothing? Offer a piece of cosmos for this song, sprung out in moving flesh, stirring frantic and dull through memory's raw blood. Cry out. Come a sweet thing, beckon wiggle, biting sauce, golden word, brilliant kiss, smash to ruts deep within, twining's first moonlight, ocean's ancient promise, love what matters and the will to accept it. Breathe. Relax. Race for music by fidelity and smoke. conjure a concert of green by slow rhythmic devotions, shiver, trust, come forth buds burst of good song, hours a twist in morning glories and whispering touch, what lasting, remnant stars in the blinding book of old dreams, what abide but eros and breath, what begins and a beat, and a beat, and a beat, someone passes smiling in crimson skirt, another's eyes quiver crazy in his rest among God and decline. What their yearn, what fulfillment. Turn, restless smoke in the air, harsh strokes across the wall. World drones, no melody, lost among the miles and years, a flatness hinting no world but beams and knots. There is no world. I told me acid told me so. No world but a squirming in the sheen. No world. Flounder, reckless flounder of drums and dust. Plunge from nothing through sparkles of a sensation to nothing, gone. No matter the great fists swinging in the night, high prayer firing through the dread house of bent limbs, thousands glad yowling with heavy thumps of song. No remain, neither tallest stone height nor whitest run of moving men and galloping machines, centuries of thrones blight, reverenced chalice of self till bloods crumble. No remain, another rotted golden song strung through history's lousy mane. Empire, relax. Another will one day rattle in your dust. Time's clay makes and mauls fists and bullets, maps and mansions alike, grinds every tongue, no farthest wall to defend, just a vastless sea of lights and hurrying. There is no world. Narcotic delusion. There is no world. You are not high enough. No world. Become a fountain of blank sheets, wet scribblings, last dull relief. Wordless, faceless. There is no world. Whither next? Your night shifts in hard remembering bones, and these will melt too. Suffer years like a trial, and its end will never come. Or cry out tonight because you can and you must, once, twice, heed no fists pressed to mum. Cry out, world's restive spirit will and again transmute your leaden dusk, slow siren into night's glints of greater evolve. Bind unity high, sweet things fine pink strum. Here is every world, here is everywhere, world's drone a lost scrap, something about to sing. Shift, jerk, long for everything, higher, higher, berry sharp as laughter jitter about your knees. This human night flails alone until someone close sings, we are all cosmos, we are careening. Coins and clocks await the morrow's bleedings of cheap hone, another pummeled day of poverty and gunfire. Empire relax, the land's blur of moving men will a while still moan for masters, hustle and praise their cheap scriptures of capitulation, this messy coalescence. No remain, what lasting? Scatter of noisy vapors, behold their great moment, a beat, another, all blows by and is gone. What abide? Starshine and cannabis? Green charms and pretty trembles? Ceaseless flu of want? Something dark in the sheen? What begins and a beat and begins again? Something true, healing prayer at the heart of the universe, neither fact nor faith. 'Twas blue fancies raised this world and others without end. Love of seed for soil and root for sunshine. Wings for high, fins for the deep. Buzz for nectar, fur for nipples suck, mortal limbs for greater light, life's tangled resolve, life's tangled resolved. 'Twas music's love to carve songs from strange contours in the night. 'Twas desire's happy ache for knowing it's one in many ways, soft, cling, soft. 'Twas want's metallic obsession, and none other but this can please, have it, love it, kill it. Blue fancies caused worlds no world, worlds without end, found play for the child's happy idol, fooled up clocks and coins at as finest measure of a man's subtle worth, blue fancies with their choice for every soul, this world an enemy, or call it home. What lasting? The music of every open hand. What abide? Love's every pock, its countless tugs upon the fabric. What begins in a beat and begins again? Hope, its mystery rise, its helpless decline. Cry out, what breeze worlds listens, and listens for you.
Did I read you the first part of The Higher Power, Lucky?
No, I don't think so.
This is a children's book. It won a Newbery Award.
Oh.
It actually caught some shit. I heard about this gal on NPR, and she got into a little bit of trouble because it's a children's book, right? And what she got in trouble for was because in the story she mentions scrotum several times.
Oh.
But I just finished this the other day. It's a really, really sweet, sweet book. It's a very good read, actually. Lucky Trimble crouched in a wedge of shade behind a dumpster.
her ear near a hole in the paint-chipped wall of the Hard Pans Found Object Wind Chime Museum and Visitor Center. She listened to Short Sammy. She listened as Short Sammy told the story of how he hit rock bottom, how he quit drinking and found his higher power. Short Sammy's story, of all rock bottom stories Lucky had heard at the 12-step anonymous programs, alcoholics, gamblers, smokers, and overeaters, was still her favorite. Sammy told of the day that he'd drunk a half a gallon of rum, listened to Johnny Cash all morning in his parked 62 Cadillac, then had fallen out of the car when he saw a rattlesnake on the passenger seat biting his dog Roy on the scrotum. Lucky balanced herself with a hand above the little hole that Short Sammy's voice was coming out of. With her other hand, she lifted the way too curly hair off of her neck. She noticed two small blackbirds nearby, panting like dogs from the heat, their beaks open, their feathers puffed up. She put her ear to the hole because Sammy's voice always got low and soft when he came to the tragic end of the story. But Short Sammy didn't head right to the good part. To stretch it out and get more suspense going for the big ending, he veered off and told about the old days when he was broke and couldn't afford to buy rum, so he made homemade liquor from cereal box raisins and any other kind of fruit that he could scrounge up. This was the usual roundabout way in which he talked, and that Lucky had noticed it made people stay interested, even if the story got quite a bit longer than if somebody else had been telling it. She stood up, her neck and the backs of her knees sweating, the mashed wads of hair under the edges of her floppy hat. She carefully angled an old lawn chair with fraying webbing into her wedge of shade and made sure the chair wouldn't break by easing herself into it. Flies came, the little biting ones. She fanned them away with her plastic dustpan. Heat blasted off of the dumpster. There was a little silence. There was a little silence except for the wobbly ticking noise of the ceiling fan inside and people shifting in their folding metal chairs. She was pretty sure that she had already heard the story of Short Sammy hitting rock bottom before, as she had, and she had loved the pure glory and splendiferousness of it as much as she did, even though it was hard to imagine Short Sammy being drunk. Short Sammy's voice sounded like he could barely stand to say what came next. "That Roy, man," said Sammy, who called everybody a man, even people like Lucky who were not a man. "He was one brave dog. He killed that snake even though they bit him in the place where it hurts the worst for a male. And there I was, trying to get out, falling out of the cab. I break a tooth, I cut my cheek, I give myself a black eye, I even sprain my ankle. But I'm so drunk, man, I don't even know that I'm messed up. Not till much later, then I pass out. Next day I wake up on the ground, sand in my mouth, and it feels like death. I mean, it's like I died, man. But at the same time, like, I'm too sick and ashamed to be dead. Mm. There's a mangled rattlesnake under the car. There's blood, lots of blood. I don't even know if it's my blood or Roy's or the snake's. Roy's gone. I called to him. Nothing. I figured maybe after saving my stupid life, he went off alone to die somewhere. It's probably like 100 degrees in the shade, man. About as hot as it is now. But I'm so cold, I can't stop shivering. Lucky's hands smelled metallic. Like the thin arms of her lawn chair, they felt sticky. She pushed her hat back from her forehead. Air cooled the sweat there. "I made this deal with myself," Sammy continued. "The deal is, if Roy is okay, I'll quit drinking, join AA, and get clean." Lucky edged her bare leg away from the rough, poking strand of chair webbing. Each time Short Sammy came to this part of the story, Lucky thought, what kind of deal would she make with herself if she hit rock bottom? Like, let's say she didn't know if her dog, the HMS Beagle, was alive or dead. She would have to do something really hard and drastic as her end of the bargain. Or let's say that her guardian just gave up and quit because Lucky did something terrible. The difference between a guardian and an actual mom is that a mom can't resign. A mom has a job for life, but a guardian like Brigitte could probably say, "Well, that's about it for this job. I'm going back to France now. Au revoir." Then there poor Lucky would stand, standing alone in the kitchen trailer at rock bottom. Then she would have to search for her own higher power and do something fearless and a searching moral inventory on herself, just like Short Sammy and all the other anonymous people had to do. Short Sammy went on. "Then my wife drives up. Man, I didn't even know she'd been gone. I'm still kind of lying there on the ground. She gets out of the car, but she don't say one word about how messed up I am. All she says is, I took Roy to the vets in Sierra City. She's talking real calm, almost like she's not mad or anything. She says, 50 miles from here, and I drove it in like maybe a half an hour. That was the worst drive of my life, Sammy, thanks to you. But Roy's okay because I got him there just in time for the anti-venom to work. Then she goes into the house and comes out with her suitcase that she must have packed the night before, and Roy's food dish and water bowl. That killed me, her taking his food dish and the water bowl. All she says to me, don't call me. That man was rock bottom. So I threw down the shovel, and here I am.
Twinkie deconstructed.
Twinkie deconstructed?
Yes.
Like Hostess Twinkies?
Mm-hmm. I thought it would be a Hostess.
Yeah. Go for it.
If you want, I can try it.
Oh, and then there's the Edward Gorey book.
Mm-hmm. So it's about Twinkies?
Yes.
Oh, the Willowdale handcart.
Oh,
I know
that's
it's
a good
something
one.
Terribly, terribly deep, but it's basically this. It says, my journey to discover how the ingredients found in processed foods are grown, mined, yes, mine, and manipulated into what America eats.
Oh.
It was really good. It's very, very well written. And so I can read your note to the reader. And then...
Did it freak you out about the contents?
Never
yeah,
look
at a
Twinkie
the same way again?
Well, it's interesting, all the little things that he goes into,
mm-hmm.
because of all the little things that he finds out all of the details of how all these things are made,
all
and
the, dirt.
The process. I mean, even like the simple ingredients as to like what other things it could be used for, like explosives and whatnot,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
like from flour.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool. It's a good book, but I just agree because I like the way he writes. Like his children were a big inspiration to him, and it's interesting how he kind of incorporates them into his writing.
So mm-hmm. So he brings them up.
Yeah.
Well.
I just thought I'd read a note to him.
Yeah.
One could be forgiven for thinking that all one might have to do to find out what goes into a Hostess Twinkie's golden sponge cake with creamy filling, is simply to ask the company if that makes it. But that is not that simple. In fact, Interstate Bakeries Corporation, one of the country's largest wholesale bakeries, which owns Hostess Drakes, Cakes, Yodels, Devil Dogs, Yankee Doodles, and Ring Dings, Wonder Bread, Home Pride, Dolly Madison Bakery, Butternut, Marita, and Cotton's Wholesome, among other brands, was initially receptive to my requests for tours and interviews. However, after about 24 hours of contemplation, the company declined via phone, citing its preference to help writers who are merely reminiscing about their sweet childhood memories.
Oh.
Despite this, Interstate could not have been nicer or more professional, and for that, I am very grateful. Plus, I got to speak with someone who has what must be the most fabulous business title ever, Vice President of Cake. So the information on Twinkies and their ingredients comes from publicly available sources, industry professionals, and academics, but not directly from Hostess/Interstate Bakeries. In researching this book, I traveled to see many of the ingredients' points of origin and processing myself, experiencing firsthand the alchemy of modern food science that turns recognizable commodities like corn and petroleum into anonymous white powders, viscous liquids, and then turns those into yellow cakes with creamy filling, among many other foods. Twinkies, of course, are not the only food products made with these ingredients. They are just a perfect example. Not only do they contain many of the most common ingredients found in processed foods, they are as familiar to most consumers as a product can be. There are, in fact, some dead-on imitations. Mrs. Freshley's Gold Cream Cakes, Little Debbie Golden Creams, and Lady Linda Cream Fingers, for starters.
Mm.
Little Debbie actually sells twice as many snack cakes of all types as Hostess, but because they are priced more cheaply than Twinkies,
that's true.
Both have annual sales of around 200 million.
25 cents.
So the functionality of each ingredient is not unique to Twinkies. The same ingredients are found in hundreds of well-known foods, such as salad dressings, ice cream, and bread, not just cakes.
Surprisingly, even Ensure nutrition shakes and toothpaste are some of these ingredients. Many of the food scientists, food science teachers, consultants, and baking professionals I spoke with have worked on creating cakes and creamy fillings over the years for many different clients and were able to share their expertise in general terms, as the cakes use all similar ingredients, though in artfully different ways. The line between art and science is very, very thin here, as it is in most baking. Also, the ingredient and the sub-ingredient manufacturers I spoke with were able to tell me how they make their products and how they are used with continued enthusiasm by a variety of customers, not just interstate bakers. All manufacturers and processes described are examples of what is likely or typical, not exactly what is done to make cakes proper. Likewise, several accomplished professionals at several different large companies in the ingredient chain offer to help, but only on condition of anonymity, seeking to avoid linking their companies with a specific ingredient or with Twinkies in particular. Mm-hmm. Often, my source was protecting proprietary information. For this reason, I have changed names in several places as a professional courtesy. Mm-hmm. This book does not reveal any proprietary information about Twinkies or other companies manufacturing nor who their suppliers are. Any ingredient manufacturer described here may or may not supply that ingredient to Interstate Bakery.
Wow.
That's a hell of a disclaimer. I know. But it's just funny because I like the first chapter talks about like how he decides to start investigating and his inspiration, which comes from his kids.
And their love of Twinkies.
Yes. The first chapter is, where does polysorbate 60 come from, Daddy? It all came to a head as I was sitting at a picnic table near the beach in Connecticut one fine August day, feeding my two little kids ice cream bars and, out of habit, casually reading the ingredient label. What you reading, Daddy? My six-year-old girl asked. The ingredient label, honey. It tells us what's inside your ice cream bars. Oops, slippery slope. Glancing back down at it, I realized it was totally incomprehensible, and most terms only barely pronounceable. So what's in it, Dad? Asked my son, a big sixth grader who started reading his own label aloud. Oh, high fructose corn syrup. What's that? Sure. What's polysorbate 60? I started to sweat. And then my sweet little girl, who at that age still thought Daddy knew everything, pitched the zinger. Where does polysorbate 60 come from, Daddy? It was a moment of truth that every parent recognizes.
Wikipedia. Go on the Wikipedia.
When you must admit your fallibility to your worshipful children.
Mix them up.
Yeah. I don't have a clue, honey. Was a rather disappointing but honest answer, I must admit. Some father I was, I could speak with a fair amount of authority about Greek olives, Spanish clementines, and tuna fish. Mm. But when faced with high fructose corn syrup, I was lost.
Sure.
Being a curious food-loving guy, I actually began to think about the question more seriously. I'd always wondered what those strange-sounding ingredients were as I read labels purely out of habit, going through the motions without ever understanding or even gaining any knowledge. Then and there, I decided to put an end to the mystery and find out. I had to find the polysorbate tree, or wherever it came from. Thinking about the origins of food is not new to me. I had lived in France for 6 years and learned how the origin and handling of wine grapes affects how the wine tastes. I visited the actual villages that Beaujolais villages comes from. I ate at restaurants featuring regional food, not just regional cuisine, but regional food. I bought fruits and vegetables, sometimes directly from the farmer at his or her farm. Now I spend most of my summers on the coast of Maine, where I can gather mussels from the nearby shore and cook them for dinner mere hours later, accompanied on occasion by fish, mackerel we've caught, and vegetables we've harvested or received from a neighbor's garden. When you eat mussels or blueberries that you have collected yourself, or a vegetable that you or your neighbor has grown, you don't have to guess where your food came from. You are consuming it as close as possible to the point of origin, reducing processing to an absolute minimum. Eat your own vegetables and fruits raw, and you've reduced processing to washing. Eating wild raspberries from your own yard as you pick them is about as short a link to food source as you can get. A luscious treat and the absolute polar opposite of modern processed food. My kids don't ask me where these berries come from. They can see for themselves. At the other extreme, the point of processed food is to have no direct link to place or even time. Processed food is meant to be national or even international, and the longer it remains ready for consumption, the better. It's been this way since people started salting, drying, or smoking their food centuries ago. I know from working as an assistant chef, eating at fine restaurants from time to time, and having done a few food-related books, that intriguing stories accompany many foods. Stories that often deal with their origins and processing, like why some beers taste bitter while others taste malty. One glorious night a number of years ago, I was treated to a custom tasting menu by Gray Kunz, one of the best chefs in the world, at his legendary four-star restaurant, Les Pinots, in anticipation of a book project we were contemplating. One dish featured a mysterious red tart sauce. In order to explain what it was made of, Chef Kunz sent out a tuxedo waiter carrying an immense silver platter lined with sumptuous white linen upon which gently rested a little branch full of red fruit. Mr. Kunz wanted you to see the source of this sauce, rose hips, the waiter explained. That fateful day on the bench with my kids inspired me to do the same for red number 40, polysorbate 60, and mono and diglycerides. However, since I lack tuxedo waiters on my staff, I wrote this book. I can picture the rose hip whenever I see the ingredient listed somewhere, even on a jar of vitamin C. It's great. It's a great natural source. And I can tell you how and where mussels grow and why the wines of Burgundy or the olive oils of Italy are different from those of Spain. A few years ago, I had absolutely no clue where most of the commonly used natural and artificial ingredients come from, how they are processed, how we came to think of using them in food, or what they do. Now I do.